Side one, Dr. Leib Kessler dictating from my diary in written in Europe in 1948. The rest of the next portion is largely personal, but I think reflects enough of the time to make it of interest to history. Because I've been so very busy, some of the events of the last 2 days have been neglected here briefly. On May 13th, after unpacking at the Bernini Hotel, which is the leading modern hotel of Rome, Dr. Glasser and I visited a half dozen Hochschorotz, spelled Hochschorots. Because the vast number of DPs in Italy are destined for Palestine, a great percentage live and work in these cooperatives. The trip was interesting, and the knowledge that I gained will appear elsewhere in this volume. For dinner, we went to the Re degli Amici, which means King of Friends. It is a typical Italian restaurant on a side street, something we would call an alley. This is a contemporary note. I find this interesting because I realize now, 47 years later, that when I wrote these lines, I nor any of my associates and friends knew anything about such restaurants. We were totally foreign to the European environment, apparently, and now, and I realized that. So even each restaurant was a new experience, which of course we all take for granted today. Our waiter was typical Italiano, good humor, no hurry, lots of fun. No one spoke English, but we managed a pretty fair dinner. The preparation was excellent. More interesting, however, was the people. They sang and laughed and ate and talked and ate with no recollection of the time. It is a noted rule here that dinner should be take at least several hours, and the waiter would never dare present a check until you say, "Prego conto." Another point of interest was the decorations on the wall, consisting of drawings in watercolor, pencil, and crayon, made by the clientele and presented to the owner. Some of them were quite good. After dinner, I wrote for a couple of hours and then retired. Yesterday, we started early in the morning to visit the medical program of joint. The details will appear elsewhere, but I really can't adequately express the marked achievements that have been made here with joint money and refugee doctors. I shouldn't fail to mention that I felt like quite a big wheel because at each installation received me royally, besides which a photographer and publicity man accompanied myself and the JDC worker, who was my guide, and I posed for many pictures in the installations and with their directors and the patients. I myself got some beautiful shots at this convalescent home. It was formerly the home of Goering when he visited in Italy. The refugees called this revenge. Most interesting of all in the medical program is the spirit, knowledge, and ability of the doctors. We were invited to lunch at the villa of Mr. Lewis Horowitz, then the director of the joint director for Italy. A man of great ability and extremely likable. His wife is also charming, and so the lunch was much enjoyed. After lunch, the tour continued, including the post-tuberculosis home, the Italian Jewish hospital, the joint hospital, and here I met Dr. Finkelstein, who has done some original work on cancer. He is greatly respected and a most gracious person. Last night was a celebration of statehood in Palestine. The refugees rejoiced, but bit their lips for the grim struggle ahead. Last night, more work, and then bed about 2:30 a.m. up at 8 o'clock to dictate a story for the states, following which was an interesting conference with Dr. Shapiro, medical director of Joint in Italy. We went over statistics, costs, and future plans, the details of which will appear elsewhere. About 11 o'clock, Mrs. Horowitz, her son, and myself went sightseeing. We visited St. Peter Chapel at the Vatican City. It is fantastic. The dome is the largest in existence, and the church is the biggest also. It took several centuries to build, having been started about 1300. The decorations, windows, and walls are all mosaic. The golden treasures there, I'm told, could liquidate our war debt. Best of all is the Michelangelo sculpture called La Pietà, the Piety. This is really a supreme work. He was very young at the time and consequently inscribed his name across the woman's breast because he didn't think that anyone would believe he did it. We also visited Palatine Hill and saw the ruins of ancient Rome. Also, Barberini's movement, Victor Emmanuel's monument, the Ark of Constantino, etc. The ruins are the best because they seem so untouchable. There's so much to see of value that I'm beginning to question my planned trip to Capri in favor of remaining here for another few days. Besides, I met a beautiful Italian this afternoon, so right now I'm on the fence. For subsequent readers, I hasten to add that I am single, and the Italian was a girl, and Jewish. In spite of my being on the fence, I still got to Capri, and I'm very happy that I did. But before I write anything about it, let me report my activities before leaving Rome. We met for dinner at 8. There was Dr. Glasser, Lou and Sylvia Horowitz, and Mrs. Cantoni. This lady was extremely interesting, a widow with 2 children, very pleasant, well-informed, and an excellent pianist. Anyway, we dined at Alfredo's, the king of fettuccine. That was superb. I'm told that Alfredo's is one of the musts on every tourist visit, and now I understand why. Besides excellent food, we were serenaded with excellent Florentine music, served in typical Italian fashion, which is in itself is so wonderfully different from ours in America. Upon leaving there, we went to a place that I now consider a must for every Roman visitor. We drove to the ruins of Rome into a little alleyway, not even big enough for our car. The place we came to was Ulpia, U-L-P-I-A. It was originally built in 111 to 114 A.D. by Apollodoro, a great architect at that time. We had to descend several flights to get to this quaint cafe. The floor and many stones are original. Inscribed plaques from ancient Rome and old wine casks decorate the walls. But all of this antiquity is far surpassed by the entertainment. A 3-piece group led by a guitar player who sings, and I mean sings, temperamental, showmanship, personality, all the attributes, comes to your table, sits with you, and with the lights very low, sings the most beautiful Florentine love songs, actually, with all of his heart and soul. In the States, it'd be good for $5,000 per. Best of all was our waiter, a squatty Italian with an extraordinary wit and a sense of humor. When we sat down, he insisted that we take some wine from the 2nd century A.D. When asked what he'd do when he runs out, he very casually replied, "I'll make some more," in Italian, of course. Sunday was a wonderful day. I had lunch with Lou and Sylvia Horowitz at their splendid villa. Afterward, we went to their club, which is beautiful. After 2 sets of tennis, we swam in an excellent pool. The club happens to be across the street from the villa. I asked if it was a Jewish club. The answer was as expected, quote, "That sort of thing is unheard of in Italy," unquote. The fees, incidentally, are equivalent to $4 per month. And imagine, I have to live in America. The next few hours were done in a rush. I had tea at Dr. Finkelstein's, a renowned man of medicine, who has done some anginal work, correction, that is original work on cancer. His wife, also a physician, was very charming. He gave me some copies of his latest papers. I was very flattered. Unfortunately, I had to leave there too soon, as the opera was next. One opera house seems more luxurious than the last. The program was Paolo e Francesca and Cavalleria Rusticana. There is no opera that has more oomph than the latter, especially when done in an Italian opera house. The curtain came down at 8:15, and my train left for Napoli at 8:50. So it was more rushing, but lots of fun, and a most enjoyable and profitable stay in Rome. Paragraph. This next section is about Capri,
and
which was a totally new experience for most Americans and most foreigners. But particularly this section carries some information that had to do with the Jewish question and the Iron Curtain at that time. After arriving at Naples late at night, there was no alternative but to stay the night in Naples and leave Monday morning for Capri. The boat left at 9 in the morning, but not until I had to dash back to my hotel for my passport. Trying to make time in Italy is an experience. The cab driver dashes in and out of people, bicycles, carts, houses, and whatnot. Half the time, he drives on the wrong side of the road and perpetually blows that infernal horn. We made it back to the boat in plenty of time, but only after quite an argument with the driver. He asked me for 1,300 lire, but we settled for 600. The boat ride was pleasant. We passed Mount Vesuvius and stopped at Sorrento. As we approached Capri, I tried to figure out how we could possibly make a landing. The island is actually a mountain. I'm sorry. The island is actually a mountaintop sticking out of the water. The sides are almost perpendicular, and from a distance, all that can be seen are white houses perched precariously on the hillsides. We landed. It was a beautiful day, and the water was clear and blue. The lift took us to the top of the mountain, a ride that any sissy should steer clear of. As we went up the landscape on both sides with beautiful flowers in full bloom and large ripe lemons and oranges began to show the beauty of Capri. I went directly to my hotel. It was as beautiful as the view, and the view from my room was breathtaking. Capri is an atypical resort. Nothing about it closely resembles anything we may have seen before. The streets, about 1.5 yards wide, are lined with quaint little shops selling the wares of Capri and thereabouts. The shopkeepers are aggressive business people. They assume an American will buy if only he is asked, and ask they do. Everybody has something to sell, and the prices always start at double of what can be finally settled for. But the bargaining is fun, and without it, Capri would not be the same. I met some very nice people on the beach, and then the piazza. There were some Britishers who have a sister in Prague. I consented to contact her about leaving for England. They seemed quite disturbed about her as she is a widow, having lost her husband at Belsom. This following report is not written in my diary, but deserves some comment now in retrospect. I was sitting, and I remember this well, in the piazza, and these people, and of course, this was prickly, so-called non-business trip. I was taking 4 days off to visit Capri and was not doing any joint or International Refugee Organization business. But I had on my agenda a plan to go to Czechoslovakia. But remember that this was 1948, and already it was May, and it was only about 2 months before that Jan Masaryk was either killed or committed suicide, as the communists tried to convince the world, in Prague, approximating the takeover of the communists in Czechoslovakia. It was therefore not long after the Iron Curtain had descended on Europe, and foreigners could not go into to Czechoslovakia any longer, nor could Czechoslovakians leave, and there were no special rules for Jews. I was planning to go to Czechoslovakia because this was arranged through the International Refugee Organization of the United Nations. Naturally, these arrangements were made by the main offices of Joint. Now, how these people knew that I was going to Prague, I have no idea. I have no idea how they knew who I was. But in Europe, and particularly at this time, there was after the war, there was still a lot of intrigue. There were few tourists in those who were tourists, or at least foreigners, were there on some business. A lot of the business had to do with intrigue, some of it particularly with regard to the establishment of the State of Israel, salvaging people from displaced persons camps, and so forth. And in the non-Jewish world, there was, of course, the question of starting up new businesses, Americans, foreigners trying to come in and get something new started. So there was a lot going on and a lot behind the scenes. The fear of communism spreading over Europe was rampant, and the fever pitch of anxiety in America was soon to be manifested through the well-known McCarthy Inquisition period. But nonetheless, they somehow did know, and somehow did find out who I was and where I was going and what I was doing there, and came up to me at the table and introduced themselves. I think I was sitting alone at the time, and began to tell me about their sister in Prague, with whom they were having trouble communicating. And since she was alone, they were very anxious to take her to England, where this one sister was living and married and had children. I later found out that the reason that they were in Capri was because they were having marital difficulties, and a friend suggested that was a good place to go to patch up their problems. They lived in the north of England, which I will cover later with some discussion about that. But I promised them, nonetheless, that I would make the contact, and I later did just that. Now back to the main text. Then there were four Finnish girls with whom I had great fun. All of them were very attractive and nice besides. It was interesting to hear them say that communism, common or approved in Finland, but they are constantly threatened by Russian domination. In fact, Russian is a required language in school. Like many other European countries, travel was severely restricted outside of their own borders because of the monetary restrictions. It was only by considerable manipulation that they managed to make the trip to Capri. Best of all was one of the four girls with whom I became closely attached in a rather short time. She is a Swedish actress with ideas that sounded like my own script. If the money holds out, I intend to visit her in Stockholm. To write more about Capri would be a futile waste of time. I could never begin to tell about it, and I'm sure the best writer would find it a difficult task. Needless to say, leaving there was extremely difficult. I'm sorry that my stay was not 3 weeks instead of 3 days. The train for Rome left shortly after the boat docked. The train was called a rapido, but the trip still took 3.5 hours. The Vienna train was already waiting, so I boarded and went to bed. On arrival, I met two young American girls in blue jeans traveling third class. In America, our cattle would insist on at least second class. So after talking to them for a while, I found that they came to Europe to go to school, but quit school 3 months ago and have been traveling since. They eat one meal a day and sleep in the cheapest hotels. Their luggage consists of one very small overnight valise, but they were extremely happy and wouldn't have traded their experiences for the entire world. They were staying in Venice, so I got off the train with them, cooked up an exchange deal with some character, and bought them something to eat. We sat in a cafe where my chair was precariously close to a canal. It would be extremely dangerous to leave a cafe in Venice half inebriated without a bathing suit. Now I'm back on the train for Vienna. We're now approaching some mountains, so the Italian border cannot be far away. That means more customs to pass. What a damn nuisance. Yes, the Italian police just came in for my passport. The train is now making its way through a vast network of rocky, precipitous mountains and cliffs. They are mostly rock, not very pretty, but very high and very majestic. This is the famous Brenner Pass. May 23rd. Excuse me. I arrived in Vienna Friday morning and immediately set to work discussing and viewing local displaced person problems. Because this is occupied territory, the setup here varies in that the International Refugee Organization has ultimate charge of the situation. Therefore, the assistance tendered to the refugees is divided between 1, the Austrian economy, 2, the IRO, and 3, JDC. Since 60% of the present Austrian economy comes from the United States, it is easy to see how the American people, in actuality, are supporting not only the Austrians, but also the basic needs of the DPs. JDC, on the other hand, provides additional services that could not possibly come from disinterested government agencies. These services are in the form of supplementary rations, mass physical examination with supplementary medical care, immigration advice and service, legal protection, rehabilitation, retraining, and education. The problems of carrying out these services are made greater by the fact that 4 different armies must be dealt with, and this requires considerable tact, patience, and neutrality. Here is an explanatory incident. Not long ago, communistic Jewish leaders of the Jewish community campaigned for office using JDC as an example of their ability to do things for the people. This was done without joint sanction, of course. However, the U.S. Army insisted that this connection with communism be positively disavowed by JDC or suffer the consequences of an uncooperative army. In principle, it would have been right to say we did not avow, and therefore we will not disavow, especially since this might endanger our operations in communist-controlled countries. But U.S. imperialism and their relentless cold battle against Russia had to be satisfied. But the job gets done, and surprisingly well at that, mainly because everybody is interested in the dollars we have to spend. I made my first visit in Vienna to the once-famous Rothschild Hospital. It is not now even fit for a stable. Only the center of the building remains after Nazi destruction did its job. But we are putting it to use nonetheless for a stopping-off hostel to accommodate the incoming DPs before they can be assigned to camps elsewhere in Austria. In addition, several rooms are provided for postnatal care of mothers and infants to ensure that they receive the supplementary care and rations that they require. It is here also that complete examinations are done on all incoming people. Later, we visited the hospital given to the Jewish community by the Nazis when they took away Rothschild Hospital. It, too, is a sad place, built for anything but a hospital. The structure is an old one. There are no elevators and none of the modern conveniences that one might expect in a hospital. But it was used during the war and is still in use for want of something better. In spite of these difficulties, every effort is made to provide excellent medical care. A cleaner hospital is nowhere to be found. Across the street, I saw the old people's home, 100 people, average age 80. These were the few old age survivors of the persecution. There are very few old people remaining in Europe today. We walked through the wards and talked to some of the people, at least those that could talk. Many are deformed and blinded, many mentally disturbed. As we approached the bed of one blind old lady, she jumped back frightened until she realized that we were friends. As we walked into rooms, those that could jump to their feet in a pitiful habit of obedience and subservience. Several times I noticed pictures of President Roosevelt and curiously questioned one group about it. They told me that he is their patron, and then added, "May his destiny be fulfilled." I felt choked all through me. Extremely interesting and informative was a meeting to which I was invited, a meeting of the newly elected officers of the Jewish community with JDC. We gathered in the JDC director's office to discuss community needs and, of course, what JDC was prepared to do about them. It was simply a matter of telling these men, all of them once proud and wealthy Jewish leaders, how much money we could allow. They sat and listened humbly as the new proposals were read, offering only suggestions or questions from time to time. It is hard to realize without seeing this that men who once no doubt sat and dictated to others could now only humbly and gratefully receive. This is a sad sight. After the meeting, they invited the director of Joint and me to Friday evening services. We sat in the rabbi's box and could watch the faces of the people who packed every available seat. They prayed in spite of the suffering experienced at the hands of their religion. They all stood without exception for the Kaddish. The synagogue could hold only about 200 people. These were but a few of the remains of the once great Jewish community of Vienna. There were 165,000 Jews in May 1938, but now there were only 9,000. These 9,000 represent those who fled and returned, or those who hid in cellars or posed as Christians, or the few whose turn had not yet come for the gas chambers when the war ended. Most of these people have nothing but a will to return to self-dependence, and to this end we are working. Proof of this is found in the figures that show 1 shilling out of 3 is now provided by the community itself. This is indeed great progress. As for me, myself, resettling in Austria would be the furthest from my mind. There were no Austrian anti-fascists in Hitler's time, but now no one will admit his past participation. They invariably blame it on the other guy. In private, they all hate the Russians, yet turned out in thousands, throwing kisses and cheers and flowers when the Russians paraded on the first anniversary of the conquest of Vienna. These Austrians are a cold and calculating people. Like the Germans, in manner and speech and custom, they kiss the feet of those on top and trample those beneath them. I, personally, and all of the people with whom I spoke, disliked being in Austria. Because of the Austrian people. And incidentally, it is quite amusing to learn that our government is treating these fascists as a liberated country, doing everything to build up and restore their economy, and with as little Russian cooperation as we can manage. Some stories that some of our officers told me would make it seem that it is us and not the Russians who are instigating this Cold War. These stories were not passed on to me in a derogatory manner, but rather as a great joke on the stupid Russians, like children getting away with something mischievous. This is the state of affairs in Austria. We are pouring great sums of money in to build a buffer against Russia. Perhaps this is necessary, but perhaps it is not, and we are once again on the way to a hopeless stalemate. If the Jewish people of Vienna wish to resettle here in spite of all this, and in spite of the fact that this is a country which has for many centuries required by law that all Jews be registered, like so many dog licenses, then we must help to make their desires feasible. As further proof of the Nazis' access to Austrian government files, I have obtained photographic copies of an extensive graphic report made by the Germans on the statistics of the Austrian Jews beginning in 1938. It is amazing to see the trouble they put themselves to, just keeping track of the Jews. This exacting report would not have been possible without the cooperation of Austrian officials on the projects of anti-Semitism. With all of the destruction of Vienna, physically and morally, there was still a brighter side to my stay there. One social evening was spent most enjoyably at the opera with Mark Breslow and his girlfriend. We had dinner at a place called the Paulusstube, which is typically Austrian, with special booths for dinner decorated with grapevines and costumed entertainers. It is called a Heuriger. I can't pronounce it very well, especially with a cold. H-E-U-R-I-G-E-R. And these places characteristically serve their homemade wine. We also took in 2 nightclubs that were no different than any other place in the world. I spent Sunday afternoon at the home of the Traubs. They happen to be from Beaver Falls, nearby Pittsburgh, and we know many people in common. Probably most interesting of all was my visit to the museum in Franz Joseph's palace or castle. The collection of paintings is superb. The old masters can't be beat. Bruegel's, Raphael's, and Dürer's one better than the next. My plane for Prague leaves Tuesday, May 25th at noon. The plane trip was splendid. It took only 1 hour and 15 minutes. But coming through Czech customs took equally as long. This was my first experience with rigid border control and found it quite disturbing. I'm told that leaving the country is much more difficult. A Dr. Fisher met me at the airport, and we proceeded to the office where I met the country director, Mr. Julius Levine. After a short orientation, I went to dinner with his assistant, Rene Reese. English, very nice. May 26th. This morning we drove to Theresienstadt, or the Little Fortress. This awful place was built many years ago by the Empress Theresien as a fortress. Later it became a prison, and now it is famous, or should I say infamous, as the outstanding political prisoner concentration camp of the Nazis. The driver of our car was there as a prisoner for the 3 months before liberation. He showed us his cell room, made for 30 people, but used for over 100. We saw the cell where the assassinator of the Austrian starting the First World War was housed, having died there of tuberculosis. To see the firing range and hangman's noose, the door which leads to certain death, and the crematorium where 40,000 people were burned, the mass graves, mostly without markers of any sort, all seem so much like a fable. But knowing that only 3 years ago, thousands of people walked those same paths to certain death makes one shiver. The stories about the Nazis' efficiency for torture and killing are amazing. Thanks to their system and chain of authority, however, our driver lives today, because not long before liberation of Prague, the camp commander wrote to his superiors for orders on how to eliminate the remaining prisoners. Fortunately, word came after the Russians, and so this Mr. Spitz lives today. I would like to add an addenda to that story that I recall, and that is that Mr. Spitz, who was our driver and worked for Joint, for many months after his liberation, so I'm told, refused to admit that he had been a prisoner there and denied much of what was obvious and much of what had happened to him. May 27th. Last night we ate at a restaurant in the old part of town, and the owner told me that it has been in his family since 1608. This morning, May 27th, I visited the Jewish Museum, the only one of its kind in the world. Its origin is even more unique. Having been first started by the Nazis in about 1941, it was their idea to collect all significant remnants of Jewry as an exhibition for posterity of a race or culture that was wiped from the face of the earth. So now, many extremely ancient and valuable articles of Jewish Orthodoxy from all of the destroyed synagogues is collected here in Prague. This local citizenry has since carried on the idea and have improved upon it. This museum is located in the old ghetto of Prague, which is supposedly the oldest in Europe. Behind the museum is the cemetery of the Jews, and this is something fantastic. Because of crowded conditions in the ghetto, bodies were laid on top of one another, and so the ground level is now much higher than the surrounding territory. The stones are side by side with hardly any free space, and many stones are beneath the surface with only the top points protruding. The oldest legible inscription is from about 1400, but there are older stones there. Many graves of great Jewish families can be found amidst the melted marble, It is estimated that 40,000 graves are located in this very small area. From there, we visited the old New Synagogue. It derives its name from the fact that the first synagogue was torn down, and on the same spot, a new one was built. That, however, was in the early 15th century. They consider it rather modern because it allows the women to pray looking through small holes in the walls separating them from the men. Its general appearance, however, does not differ greatly from any of the Orthodox synagogues in the United States. In fact, it is amazing to see how similar are the architecture and articles of prayer and so forth, regardless of their age. A wedding was getting underway at that time, and I was surprised to see that the people there looked very much like any other Jews attending a wedding. After leaving the ghetto, we went to the other extreme, having lunch at a luxurious mountainside restaurant. It is an architect's idea of Hollywood: swimming pool, terrace dancing, and scenery to boot. I forgot to mention that the music festival is in full swing, and I was fortunate enough to hear Beethoven's first and third symphonies performed by the Prague Philharmonic, conducted by Eric Kleibert. The audience went wild. May 27th. While in Capri, I met an English couple who asked me to call their sister in Prague. They seemed deeply concerned about her, so I did call as soon as I arrived. Tonight we met, and a lovelier person could not be found in Czechoslovakia, even if I had hand-picked her. But she is extremely unhappy. Her mother, father, three brothers, and husband all died in concentration camps. She managed to live through 3 years of hell in Theresienstadt, Auschwitz, Hamburg, and Belsum. The indelible number on her arm is plainly visible. The difficulty with which she smiles is equally as obvious. When I asked her how she was fortunate to escape with her life, the answer was another question: was I fortunate? For now, she is completely alone in Prague. She loved her husband dearly, and she speaks of her mother as a queen. Now she works as a secretary and maintains a little flat, but more than anything wants to join her sister in England. At first, it was not possible to get into England, but now that it might be arranged on that end, it is impossible to leave Czechoslovakia. I am told that the people here can go only to Yugoslavia and nowhere else. There might be one chance for her, that is, to marry an Englishman or an American. Every day she cries from loneliness, and yet I cannot help her. It is hard to understand that people can be forced to live where they are not happy, but this is only one of the many faults of the communist domination. In fact, we went into a locked room and whispered so as to carry out our conversation. You can never be sure but that someone listening will have you blacklisted. Since there is little I can do for her, I pledge at least to make her laugh a few times before I leave Prague. The fact that she is very attractive should make this task most pleasurable. May 28th. This morning I was escorted to the local institution, subvention by joint. The tour included a children's home, old home, two student homes, a transitaire hostel, and a kosher kitchen. Much to my surprise, these were all far above average in appearance and facility. The rooms were spotless and the people looked well-kept and well-fed. These high standards are possible because a large percentage of Jewish population here is already repatriated, having returned here after the war. The transient problem is not as great because people are immediately moved on to Austria and Italy. This is necessary because of government restriction on settling, period. In addition, the state subventions social welfare agencies, all types, So that at present, the cost of welfare in the Czech Czech lands is 50% to JDC, and only 30 to 40% in Slovakia. Similarly, education is paid by the state, with living allowance also provided except for foreign students, in which case joint supplies the house. Correction, that's the Bourse, B-O-U-R-S-E. However, the problem is not solved by any means. In talking with many young people, and older people as well, I have found considerable unrest with regard to communistic control, mainly because its rigid control seems to them too much like the days in which fascism began to sprout. Therefore, many people who were repatriated and even contributing to the general welfare are now speaking of emigration. Where they would prefer is not too important, but the declaration of statehood in Israel has raised considerable hope that emigration will be possible. I met one man who leaves for America tomorrow. When he told me this, his face lit up like a beacon light. This is pleasant to see. This afternoon, we visited the tower, which gives a beautiful view of Prague and the Moldau River. The city is beautiful, like most large cities in Europe. We also visited the Church of St. Vitus, which is another example of extravagance at the expense of the stomachs of the little people who have to build these monuments. Inside is a coffin of some saint in solid silver from about the 14th century. Or I think it was St. Vitus. It isn't even pretty, but it would probably feed a lot of hungry bellies. But the value is probably better in silver than in bullets. So perhaps the church has the right idea after all. I just had a nice evening at dinner with Julius Levine, his wife, Hannah. That is his wife and Hannah, and Renee Reese and George Matthews. The food, music, and service were all very good, and we didn't have to give ration coupons. But when the in Czechoslovakia, it's platit, or check, came, we all understood. $8 per person. Now, I say that $8 per person, meaning that that was quite expensive, though it doesn't seem that way now, but that's why we didn't have to give ration coupons. Hannah and I talked a great deal about her future, and the more we talked, the more I realized her desperation. There are slim possibilities of getting her out of Czechoslovakia, but her state of mind is not favorable for the involved task which would be necessary. There are other blocks as well. The fact that she would have to leave penniless and then be a dependent, plus her unwillingness to marry an Englishman, both are serious deterrents. The latter point may seem presumptuous, but I can readily understand what she means when she refers to the odd and different temperament of an Englishman. May 29th. This morning was well spent on a trip to a farm under the Hachshara setup. That's spelled H-A-C-H-S-H-A-R-A-H. That's a form of training program in preparing for Israel. It is wonderful to experience pure idealism, and such a visit makes this possible. 20 boys and girls, averaging 20 years of age, living, working, and farming 60 acres as training for a life in Palestine. The cooking, laundry, and all other, I can't read it, but all, and all other necessities of living are provided by themselves. When the first crop comes in, they will be self-sufficient and perhaps even pay back the money given them by for a start by joint. The period of training is 1 to 2 years. 12 of their group have already left for Palestine. Their belief is so different from the usual, that is, that work and faith will provide security, and that security in no way relates to any of the superficialities of life, the luxuries that many of us take for granted. It is hard to believe that idealism can exist in this world of pretense, that it will last when the pressure is not so great is certainly questionable, perhaps because people forget quickly their suffering. However, the theory is perfect, and no doubt the day will come when such will be the accepted way of life. But I will be gone and forgot by then.